Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Gavin Butt, author and professor of fine art at Northumbria University. And we're talking about his new book, No Machos or Pop Stars, When the Leeds Art Experiment Went Punk. Gavin, welcome to the show. It is a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Great to be here, Mark.
I don't know what I was expecting. I was fascinated by the title. And what I got was a very serious and very interesting analysis of the Leeds Art School and the emergence of certain bands and sounds and connecting the two of them. How did you come up with this idea for writing this book?
It started quite some time ago now, actually, probably about 10 years ago. Things were changing dramatically in the university sector here in the UK. We had a change of heart in the government, and new legislation was brought in to triple the fees for university entrance. And it made me reflect on times past, indeed why I went to university, to art school more specifically, many moons ago in the 1980s. And it was in part because I was a fan of the Three Johns.
And you talk about that band right at the beginning of the book. But, you know, that's one of the,
right.
Unlike Gang of Four and Delta Five and the rest of the bands that are dealt with in this book, I don't think the Three Johns really made it across the water here.
Probably not. There was a number of bands, actually. They weren't the only one that came out of the Leeds scene that didn't make it across the water to the U.S. And I wanted to write a book about all of the bands that were part of a broader scene, which was really enabled by... at least in part, by an art college education in the late 70s and early 80s. So I really wanted to kind of reflect back to how significant the art education was for these people who ended up being in bands. I mean, some of them, of course, did make it across the water to the U.S., Gang of Four, you mentioned.
Mekons made it across.
Exactly. And, of course, Soft Cell.
Yeah, of course, Soft Cell. Scritti Politti made it across.
They certainly did. And all of these bands and more came out of a very kind of small-scale city scene that was significantly impacted by the teaching in two very different art departments of then called Leeds Polytechnic and the University of Leeds. And that scene has been kind of overlooked for various reasons in favor of Manchester and Liverpool London. Also, of course, New York on the international stage and Dusseldorf. So I really wanted to explore what the significance of art college was to the formation of those bands, and also perhaps try and shed a bit of light on why Leeds has been so almost criminally overlooked in recent decades.
There's so many important threads in this book, and one of them is about class and education. And I want to start out by talking about art school education in Britain at the time. First of all, it was broadly state-funded from 1962 to 1986. Can you explain how that works?
Yeah, that's really crucial to my reasons for wanting to write this. Basically, access to higher education in the UK from 1962, from the date of a UK Government Education Act, that mandated the sector to provide maintenance grants to all those who wished to study and who secured a place at art school from 1962 onwards. They were basically given a grant to study there for 3 years by their local education authority. That was their kind of spending money, if you like. But also, there were crucially no fees to pay, as there are today and, of course, as there are in the U.S. System as well. So it really, the access arrangements were such that people from relatively poor socioeconomic backgrounds could access something as arcane as an art education, and in the case of the Leeds Art School, a fairly kind of radical avant-garde art education, without being kind of, you know, worried about being saddled with a lifetime of debt thereafter. So the system really did allow for people from different class backgrounds to meet each other at art college. And really that's part of what fuels this scene, or at least that's what I argue in the book. It's those access arrangements that allow the kind of post-punk experimentation to take place across these students from very different class backgrounds and from different parts of the country.
It's fascinating. This was this whole program, if I can call it that, was stopped by Thatcher.
Yeah, well, the Thatcher government the Thatcher government began to unpick these arrangements, and then subsequent administrations, the Major administration, the Blair administration. So, you know, Labour aren't totally blameless in this. But it was in 2010 when the so-called Con Dem government in the UK, that was the government made up of Conservatives and Liberal Democrats, they decided to triple the fees that had been introduced by that stage from £3,000 a year to over £9,000 a year. And that's made it decidedly more difficult for people from lower class backgrounds to envisage, you know, taking up a three-year place on a fine art course, because they're going to be kind of saddled with pretty humongous levels of debt thereafter. So the kind of class mixing that you got back in the 70s and into the 80s is simply not possible today in the UK system in the same way.
It's fascinating. This is a book that has many nuances in it. And you did a lot of research on this. You interviewed students who were in the art schools at the time. And what you were surprised to find out is not all students thought it was a great experience.
Yeah, that was my most rude awakening, I guess, in doing the research for this book, is that I was looking back, perhaps through rose-tinted spectacles, you know, from the vantage point of the present-day arrangements. And so I was seeing all these well-funded programs and no fees to pay, et cetera, et cetera. And then I was really taken aback by the degree to which a lot of people, not all by any means, but a sizable majority, let's say, had critical things to say about their time at art school, perhaps even withering things to say about their time. And so the book began to take a slightly different track, to take account of the kind of disillusionment, really, that a lot of these kids felt in going to art school in the 70s. And I began to realize that I was writing about this particular moment in the late 70s, early 80s, when art education was actually in crisis.
That's right. That's
UK,
exactly.
And it was beginning to lose its way a bit. And in
Can we just talk about that? What was that crisis?
Yeah. The crisis was, the crisis of an institutionalized avant-garde. So at Leeds Polytechnic, for example, Leeds had become famous, internationally famous, by the way, including people looking to Leeds from the US, art educators in the US looking towards Leeds, became famous for experimental art education, for training artists, and designers in forms of open-ended experiments. So not that they weren't expected to produce like customary forms of art at the end of it, like paintings or sculptures. They were encouraged to experiment and produce whatever kinds of expressions they deemed to be appropriate to the contemporary situation. So, you know, students were making performance art. They were making conceptual art which existed at the level of a proposed idea, or they were making theatre. they were basically embracing a whole panoply of experimental forms of expression, much, you know, very much beyond the purview of traditional painting and sculpture. But by the mid 70s, when, of course, the international outlook is looking a bit gloomy, you've got the oil crisis, and you've got Western economies entering into a recessionary cycle. All of this experimentation in art begins to look a bit played out, and it begins to look like it has little or even nothing to say about the very changed social realities of the 1970s, with the rise of the right wing of the National Front the UK, with the emergence of second wave feminist politics. The avant-garde seemed to have little to say about that. In most instances, it was quite led by men. It was even macho in some respects. So all these people that I interviewed who go to art college in the mid-70s, basically, they begin to think, how important or useful is the avant-garde?
That's one of the amazing things that you bring up in your book is, you have art students questioning why are they art students?
Exactly that, yes. And I think had it not been for punk rock, some of them may have ended up just bailing, and kind of leaving and not completing their courses. Such was the disillusionment that a number of them felt, yeah.
This is sort of an unprecedented connection between art and the avant-garde that you write about in this book. It's really amazing, this Marxist aesthetics, dialectics. There's a great cover of Melody Maker in your book where it says dialectics meet disco.
Exactly. Yeah.
I love that cover. But it's about trying to make music think, and that's what these bands were trying to do in different ways. And you talk about again the sense of the avant-garde is dead. What do we do next? I mean, that's what the big impulse for these bands are, is okay. Avant-garde, and there's also the other problem that art schools by their very nature seem elite. It doesn't matter how you try to restructure it, art schools are elite.
Totally, and I think one of the reasons, perhaps even the reason, why this generation of students began to think like that about art schools was because of the advent of punk rock. And punk seemed to provide a form of expression, a culture that was broadly engaging to young people. So it was very far from the kind of elite forms of avant-garde that these students were encountering in the art studios, because it was about embracing kids from all walks of life. The kids had nothing to do ostensibly with forms of art or high art, and so I think punk provided, if you like, I don't know, an alternative template for a different kind of culture that might be made in the wake of the avant-garde having kind of failed or had come to a bit of a kind of sticky dead end. I guess that what's important about the book, however, is that even though members of Gang of Four, Skritti Politti, Soft Cell, etc. might, generally speaking, be thinking like this about the art school as they move into making popular music, they nevertheless take some elements of their art school training with them out into popular culture, as it were, and so that they don't, as it were, leave the avant-garde behind in the art studios when they start going on tour and playing rock venues.
That's right.
They actually pick up some like key ideas or pointers from their avant-garde education and begin to kind of retool it, use it in different ways in making music.
All you have to do is look at Gang of Four's album Entertainment. The cover art, it's an artwork.
It is indeed. And there is a number of other bands that similarly embraced the kind of creative aspects of packaging their works, and not just because they wanted to sell, to kind of shift units. They weren't interested in kind of the traditional, if you like, marketing imperative of the design of the cover. They wanted the cover, let's say in the case of Gang of Four, to serve a critical function. They wanted to get their listeners to reflect on the power relationships that were at play in popular music, not in the least, perhaps, between Gang of Four's relationship to their label, EMI,
that's right,
a major record company, and perhaps some of the paradoxes or contradictions in being a band that was explicitly embracing, in some cases, kind of Marxist theory in helping shape their ideas and even shape the form of their music, and them signing up to a major capitalist label like EMI in order to get their stuff out there in the world.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Gavin Butt, author and professor of fine art at Northumbria University, and we're talking about his new book. It's a really interesting book. No Machos or Pop Stars, When the Leeds Experiment Went Public. Gavin, we should talk a little bit about the difference between Leeds University and Leeds Polytechnic. Was there a tremendous difference between the art programs in the two schools?
Yeah, I would say it was pretty enormous, actually, back in the day, in the 1970s. Leeds Polytechnic, well, that grew out of its precursor institution, Leeds College of Art, which, as I already mentioned a moment ago, was much more avant-garde in its orientation, let's say. It looked back to earlier 20th century movements in European modernism, to avant-garde movements like Surrealism and the Futurists, as a kind of template for what they were trying to do, what the staff were trying to do with the students. Jeff Nuttall was one of the leading lights on the staff there from 1970 onwards. He was the author, of course, of Bomb Culture, the countercultural Jeremiad from the late 1960s. And he wanted students to basically set out to shock, to shock their audience members with a view to, as it were, shaking them out of their complicity with structures of power. So the more shocking, the better. For someone like for Jeff Nuttall, whereas at the university it was quite a different kind of setup, really, especially from 1976 onwards, when the social historian of art T.J. Clark, quite a young guy then, he was only about 32, I think, when he was appointed as head of the Department of Fine Art at the university. He kind of brought about, by his own admission, a kind of changing or even a kind of grinding of the gears of the department, because he began to bring in Marxist theory, and then some of the other staff that were appointed alongside him, like Griselda Pollock, the feminist art historian, began to bring in politicized perspectives into the study of the history of art and of contemporary art, and that created a kind of differently radical institution, just only, as it were, up the road from Leeds Polytechnic.
Wow. Wow.
So students really came together between, these two very singular art departments. And they often met in probably the only public institution that was interspersed between these two, and that was a pub called the Fenton, which is almost like mythical now in reflecting back on this period, because that's where a lot of the kind of connections, a lot of the meetings between the various people that ended up being in bands and became movers and shakers on the scene, that's where they met and where they regularly, that was their social world, basically.
Okay, I don't want to go out of time before we talk about December 6th, 1976.
Yeah, exactly.
When punk came to Leeds, I love your writing about this, because it was one of these legendary concerts that everybody says they were at, but only like a very tiny few people were at. This was the Anarchy in UK tour. The Sex Pistols had already sort of made a big splash in the press. The Filth and the Fury headline had already come out, right?
Yeah, that's right.
But the lineup of this is amazing. Who played in this concert?
So this was the first gig that went ahead as planned for the Anarchy in the UK tour, after the famous Grundy incident where the Sex Pistols swear on national TV. And so the Sex Pistols, of course, were the headliners, but alongside them were the Damned, the Clash, and Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers.
From the US?
From the US, of course, yes. So there was one, if you like, CBGB's band in the Heartbreakers, and then three homegrown UK punk acts, all that could be seen on the same bill for a measly £1.50.
Wow!
yeah. So yeah, because of their kind of very recently kind of generated national profile for themselves as like contemporary folk devils or something, the Sex Pistols and the Anarchy Tour brought in a sizable audience to Leeds Polytechnic on December the 6th, 1976, because people were curious as to, yeah, to what they were going to do next, of course. And the art students weren't to be outdone by that, because many of them were there that evening. Many members of bands that would form very quickly thereafter.
That's right.
So Gang of Four, Skritti Politti, Soft Cell, Mekons, and others were in that crowd that night. And I've interviewed them about this. For some of them, it was almost like a Road to Damascus moment.
Yeah. What I found fascinating about your interviews is not everybody was knocked out by the Sex Pistols. It was the Clash.
Yeah.
That really, really knocked people's socks off.
Yeah. For some people, Mark White, for example, of the Mekons, it was the Clash. And according to him, at least, it was because they seemed to represent a kind of DIY ethos, yeah, that was readily kind of it was already valid for art students, because it looked like a very arty enterprise. That they made their own shirts, for example, with stencils and the designs on their shirts with stencils and whatnot. But they also seem to be extending that DIY ethos to playing their instruments. And that's in part, I think, what led to the Mekons, or the idea for the Mekons, that a bunch of art students could get together without any proficiency in being able to play musical instruments at all, and that would be the idea for the band. And so the Mekons were born. And, you know, historically, now perhaps infamously, they recorded their first single for Fast Product Records in Edinburgh. And then when Bob Last of Fast Product tried to get Rough Trade to distribute it, they refused on the grounds that they thought that the Mekons' debut was just terrible. In some ways, you might say, an inauspicious beginning for a Leeds post-punk band. But perhaps that was the defining feature of Leeds post-punk, perhaps supported by the idea that they could float and make an art band out of an idea, something as kind of small, as it were, as this initial conceit.
There are so many interesting parts of your book. One of the fascinating things for me was reading about Andy Gill's final dissertation. Now, he had studied with Timothy James Clark, who would do these close descriptions of his single artwork. And Andy Gill wrote his final dissertation on Manet's Le Déjeuner dans l'Hôtel. And
exactly.
Out of that comes a theme of social alienation, mm-hmm, which you can see at a home. He thinks he's a tourist.
Absolutely. That was one of the great joys of doing the research for this book, when, of course, Andy was still with us.
Oh, yeah.
Is that he shared his dissertation with me, his undergraduate dissertation.
Wow.
And I got the impression when he did so that nobody had even thought about this dissertation, least of all himself, since he'd written it all those years ago in 1979. It was quite exciting for me to be able to read the granular detail of his engagement with Clark's pedagogy. And then I was taken aback, I guess, by the kinds of resonances between his analysis of Manet's painting and,
yeah,
all the themes that he saw at play in Manet's painting. And, of course, the themes that were developing in Gang of Four's music at precisely the same time that he's writing this dissertation. And so that's what I tried to delineate in the book, was how some of that kind of art historical work that he was doing, quite surprisingly, ended up being a resource for thinking about the project of Gang of Four.
It's fascinating, too, we're going to run out of time. We only have a few minutes left, but there were organizations like Rock Against Racism, and that these groups would participate in, and this all comes out of their art education, too, anti-British movements, anti-fascist demonstrations.
Yeah.
These people who were in these bands were all involved, not all, but some of them were really involved in these leftist movements.
Totally, and I think that's why punk appealed so much, because in the Rock Against Racism movement, members of like Delta 5, Gang of Four, Mekons, yep, could see that something could be done about the growing problem of racism in Britain, and the growing racism within working class communities. And of course, the Rock Against Racism movement set out to explicitly redress that situation. And that was something that, of course, avant-garde art had no chance of doing.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas post-punk music had, a much more of a, if you like, political capital to be able to make a difference in the politics of race in 1970s Britain. So I think that was another reason why punk music, post-punk music, rather than avant-garde art, seemed to be a better bet for the people who wanted to make a change and to, as John King said to me in an interview, to change the world.
We're completely out of time. We've only scratched the surface of this book. My guest tonight has been Gavin Butt, author and professor of fine art at Northumbria University. And we've been talking about No Machos or Pop Stars, When the Leeds Art Experiment Went Punk. A really fascinating read. Gavin, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.